Let me tell you something. The truth is, it is easy to be negative. It doesn't take practice. It doesn't take effort. In fact, negativity almost feels natural. It is as if it is the default human behavior, to doubt, to expect the worst, to fixate on problems, to criticize ourselves and others. That default is deeply embedded into the way we are wired. It is much harder to be neutral, let alone positive. It requires a conscious rewiring of the mind, a deliberate stance of awareness and strength. To be neutral or to hold a positive outlook in the face of uncertainty or difficulty requires internal strength. It takes discipline to kill your negative thinking. It takes vigilance to stop yourself in the middle of a pessimistic spiral and change direction. That alone is proof of its difficulty. If it were easy, the world would look much different. The truth is, discipline is the dividing line between the person who becomes a prisoner of their own thoughts and the one who gains their freedom. That discipline must begin with an honest acknowledgement. The mind defaults to the negative, not because it is broken, but because it evolved that way. Our ancestors survived by being alert to danger, by assuming the worst might happen. Negativity was a tool for survival. But survival is not the same as living. What once served us now enslaves us. Today, that ancient survival mechanism is hijacked by stress, fear, insecurity, and emotional reactivity. We no longer hunt wild animals, but our thoughts still stalk us. We don't run from predators, but we run from our failures, from judgment, from imagined fears. We must evolve beyond the wiring. When something doesn't go the way we expected, we often collapse inward. Our mood drops. We grow bitter. We attack ourselves with guilt, or we project our anger outward in resentment. And every time we let this happen without resistance, we make it easier for it to happen again. It becomes automatic, and anything automatic is difficult to interrupt. But this is not the way. This is not the life of someone aiming to live with virtue. The Stoics taught that virtue begins with self-governance, the ability to regulate your responses and detach from the grip of emotional impulses. That means you must kill the reflex to be negative before it becomes habitual. You must create a new default, one that is built on perspective, clarity, and reason. When you begin to change the way you approach your own thoughts, everything else changes. You start to solve problems instead of stewing in them. You stop assigning blame and begin to take responsibility. You stop reacting and start responding. You become more creative, more open to solutions, more grounded in the present. Negativity blinds you. It closes doors and shuts down possibilities. But awareness opens them. The issue is that negativity is often invisible to us. We carry it in our tone, in our expectations, in the way we speak to ourselves silently. It's embedded in our self-talk, hidden in the assumptions we make, and even in the things we choose not to pursue because we've convinced ourselves we're not good enough. You must become completely aware of your thoughts. You must train yourself to observe them before you absorb them. Stop yourself when you notice that bitterness is rising, when pessimism starts to cloud your judgment, when resentment creeps into your reactions. Because all of these are like slow poison, silent, subtle, and corrosive. They solve nothing. They change nothing. They only weaken you and strip you of your clarity. If you don't stop them, they will build a home inside you, and that home will become your prison. This is where Stoicism enters, not as an ancient philosophy to admire from a distance, but as a practical daily tool to use in the trenches of life. The Stoics knew a dangerous truth. If you don't master your thoughts will master you. And if your thoughts are saturated in negativity, your actions, your habits, and your entire way of being will be shaped by that corruption. This is the inner war. And today, we begin to fight back. Let's examine, piece by piece, how to break the chain. Chapter 1. the trap of automatic negativity. Negative thinking is like breathing for many people, unnoticed, unchallenged, automatic. When Marcus Aurelius said, "You have power over your mind, not outside events. Realize this and you will find strength," he pointed at the core battle of existence. The problem is not that we have negative thoughts. The problem is that we believe them, we obey them, we feed them. We say, "This always happens to me," or "I can never catch a break," or "Things never change." These thoughts form invisible prisons, and we do not see the bars because we are the ones reinforcing them. Seneca wrote, "We suffer more often in imagination than in reality, and yet we do not investigate the imagination. We let it run wild with fears, projections, self-loathing, and revenge fantasies. Why? Because we haven't trained our minds to interrupt the pattern. Start today by identifying one common negative belief you hold. It might be something you've repeated to yourself for years. "I'm not good enough. People always let me down," or "Nothing ever works out for me." Whatever it is, don't justify it. Interrogate it. Look at it under a mental microscope. Question its origin. Did it come from your own experience, or did you inherit it from someone else? Was it planted by an early failure, by a harsh critic, or by cultural conditioning? Ask if it serves you. Does this belief help you grow, make decisions, or strengthen your character? Or does it weaken your resolve, sabotage your efforts, and poison your view of life? Most negative beliefs feel like they are protecting us, but they are often cages disguised as comfort. Observe the thought without judgment. You are not your thoughts. You are the one watching them. This is not suppression. It is awareness, elevated into wisdom. The first strike against negativity is not to argue with it or to suppress it by sheer force of will, but to notice it calmly, clearly, and repeatedly. That quiet recognition over time strips negativity of its disguise and weakens its grip. Journal your negative thoughts for 1 week. Categorize them: fear, comparison, regret, resentment. Then reflect. Which of these thoughts are facts? Which are interpretations? Which are inherited? Awareness weakens their power. Chapter 2. Rewiring the mind through Stoic perception. Epictetus taught, "It's not what happens to you, but how you react to it that matters." If you let this quote settle deep into your bones, you will see the blueprint for mental liberation. Rewiring your mind begins with changing how you see. Negative thinking thrives in misperception. A rude text becomes a personal attack. A delay becomes proof of failure. A rejection becomes a declaration of worthlessness. A missed opportunity becomes a permanent label of inadequacy. A glance is interpreted as judgment. These mental distortions are subtle, yet powerful. Our minds are constantly filling in gaps with assumptions, and those assumptions are almost always painted in the worst possible light. But these are stories, not realities. They are mental projections, not objective truths. The Stoics were master editors of their own narrative. They understood that perception, not reality, was the battleground, and they learned to revise their thoughts with precision and discipline. To kill negative thinking, we must change our interpretations. We must learn to see events not as conclusions, but as questions. Questions that demand reasoned answers. When Marcus Aurelius faced setbacks in war and governance, he didn't spiral into self-pity or outrage. He didn't think, "Why me?" He asked, "What opportunity does this hold?" That shift in framing was no accident. It was the result of training. That is Stoic alchemy, turning obstacle into opportunity. The Stoics saw every adversity not as a curse, but as a chance to refine the self. And that is the power available to you right now. Not to change the world, but to change how you see it. This shift isn't about delusion or forced positivity. It is not about pretending everything is great when it's not. It's not about sugarcoating reality or turning away from the hard truths of life. It's about clarity, about clearing the fog of fear, ego, and emotion to see what is actually in front of you without the filter of panic or self-deception. Clarity is what allows us to respond instead of react. It's what lets us take ownership of our perspective rather than being hijacked by our first impulse. When we remove the emotional fog, we begin to see that most events are neutral, devoid of inherent meaning, empty, until we project our own narratives onto them. A criticism is just words. A failure is just a result. A delay is just a moment in time. But the way we interpret these events, the tone we assign them, the intent we assume behind them, that's where their power begins to grow. Our reaction gives them color, like a painter choosing their palette. Our perspective gives them weight, either light enough to move through or heavy enough to hold us down. We must reclaim that power, the power of assigning meaning, not from a place of weakness or woundedness, but from a place of wisdom and strength. This means you do not assign meaning based on your mood, your fears, or your emotional exhaustion. You assign meaning with intention, with presence, with a deep understanding of what you want to become. You assign meaning like a craftsman shaping stone, carefully, deliberately, knowing that every stroke defines the sculpture of your character. With clarity, you begin to filter your thoughts through the lens of virtue rather than vulnerability. With courage, you resist the urge to assign meaning that reinforces helplessness. You choose the path of strength, not survival. Every time you reframe a situation, whether it's a small inconvenience or a major life disruption, every time you catch yourself spiraling and choose a more grounded interpretation, you are not just shifting a moment, you are constructing a life. You are not just changing the lens, you are changing the landscape. You are practicing the art of resilience in real time. And the more often you do this, the more natural it becomes. Reframing becomes a reflex, a trained response that transforms your default state from panic to poise. With every reframed moment, we weaken the roots of negativity and strengthen the foundation of reason. We begin building a mindset fortified by logic and tempered by patience. We construct a mental framework that doesn't crumble at every inconvenience or collapse under every emotional gust of wind. Instead, it holds like steel under pressure. It bears weight like a bridge designed for storms. And through that sturdiness, we become more than mere reactors to life. We become measured, intentional responders. We become the calm in the chaos, the clarity in the noise, the still center in the swirl of demands and disruptions. We no longer simply survive, we lead ourselves. Each night, reflect on one negative moment from your day. Choose a moment that triggered you, disrupted your peace, or left a lingering emotional residue. Then take a step back and examine it from a stoic lens. Ask yourself what truly happened. Separate the facts from the emotional noise. Strip the moment of judgment and narrative. What could it have taught you about your expectations, your attachments, or your assumptions? Were you reacting to what occurred or to what you feared it meant? Now, rewrite the event in a way that aligns with stoic discipline. Frame it as an opportunity, an invitation to grow in patience, an occasion to practice self-control, or a prompt to deepen your understanding of impermanence. Ask yourself, how could I have responded better? What virtue was lacking in that moment, and how can I strengthen it tomorrow? This isn't about guilt, it's about gaining clarity and sharpening your inner edge. This nightly reflection rewires perception by training the mind to reinterpret adversity, not as something to be avoided or resented, but as a tool for transformation. When done consistently, this practice builds mental reflexes that favor calm over chaos, presence over panic, and virtue over emotional turbulence. It carves the path from reactivity to reason, helping you wake each morning stronger than you were the day before. Chapter 3: The Emotional Hijack and How to Stop It. Negative thinking often rides in on a storm of emotion: anger, fear, envy, shame. These emotions are not the enemy, but they are poor leaders. When they take control, logic, patience, and clarity vanish. The Stoics knew that to be ruled by emotion is to be enslaved. Emotional dominance turns you from an agent of intention into a servant of impulse. And once that happens, your actions no longer reflect your values. They reflect your volatility. Keep your emotions in check, Marcus Aurelius urged himself. It's not manly to be enraged. It's childish. Why? Because anger is reactive, not reflective. It strikes first and thinks later. It surges like a wildfire, fast, loud, and destructive. Fear is frantic, not stable. It sends false alarms, convincing us to flee before danger is even real. Envy looks outward, not inward. It places value on what others possess, while eroding our appreciation for what is already ours. These emotions hijack the rational mind, turning your inner compass into a spinning dial. They drown out reason, distort judgment, and fill your mental space with noise. What results is not clarity, but confusion; not direction, but distraction. You don't just lose your peace, you lose your ability to make wise decisions. To live by Stoic principles is to stop letting emotions write your story. It's not about denying the emotions, but about understanding them and refusing to let them dictate your actions. The Stoic doesn't pretend they're unaffected. The Stoic trains for control. How do we stop the hijack? By introducing pause. The moment you feel the emotional surge, breathe, count, step back, detach. Acknowledge the emotion, name it, but don't become it. Observe the emotion as if watching it rise on a tide, momentary, powerful, but passing. Say, "This is a sensation, not a command." That simple internal line, spoken with awareness, separates you from the flood. It creates a sacred distance between what you feel and what you do. You remind yourself that emotions are guests, not kings. They will visit. They may stay longer than you want. They may make noise. Let them. But don't hand them the keys to your behavior, your voice, or your decisions. Don't make permanent choices from temporary states. With time and repetition, the pause becomes a habit. The breath becomes a shield. The observation becomes armor. You begin to build a system of response, not reaction, a mental discipline that does not deny emotion, but refines it. The more often you create space between stimulus and response, the more control you develop. That space becomes a sanctuary, a quiet interval where you weigh intention against impulse, clarity against confusion, reason against reaction. Over time, that space becomes familiar, a sacred ground where you return not in fear, but in power. You begin to understand that you are not required to be at the mercy of every trigger, every provocation, or every emotional surge. That you have the power to slow things down, to observe before you act, and to regain your composure even in the heat of distress. This inner sanctuary is not built overnight. It is forged through daily practice, through the disciplined act of choosing stillness over chaos, reflection over eruption, observation over instinct. The modern world is loud, fast, reactive. Everywhere we look, we are encouraged to respond quickly, defend ourselves instantly, and voice every frustration. But the Stoic chooses another way. They train to pause. They build the muscle of restraint. Not to suppress emotion, but to understand it, to refine it, and to choose a higher response. It is in this space that you learn the art of restraint, of measured thought, of strength held quietly. You discover the wisdom of not needing to prove your point, the courage to delay gratification, the maturity to wait before speaking. In this stillness, you're no longer driven by the tides of emotion, but guided by the anchor of reason. It is where you remember that your dignity is not up for trade just because the world presses its weight upon you. Dignity is internal. It is preserved in silence, in self-respect, in those private victories where you choose not to be ruled by chaos. It becomes second nature to recognize your own rising anger, fear, or resentment, and respond with inner distance, not immersion. You begin to witness your mind with detachment, catching yourself in the act of escalation and stepping back before the spiral takes hold. You see your emotions arrive like clouds in the sky, transient, shifting, unable to define the sky itself. And in that space, in that hard-earned pause, is your power to kill the negative spiral before it begins. That space is where wisdom lives, not the kind learned from books, but the kind carved through lived tension, surrendered impulses, and repeated victories over reaction. That space is where self-respect is preserved, when you refuse to say what you don't mean, when you protect your values instead of your ego, when you prioritize peace over the need to be right. That space is where the Stoic stands, rooted and ready, not because life is calm, but because they are. They have trained for the storm. They do not panic when it arrives. They prepare for it daily. While the world spins in chaos, the Stoic does not flinch. They meet life not as a victim of emotion, but as a commander of thought, holding fast to what they can control, their response. That is the highest form of power, inner command. Practice the Stoic pause. When you feel triggered, do nothing for 10 seconds. Breathe. Ask yourself, is this emotion leading me or misleading me? Then respond with intention, not impulse. Chapter 4. The voice in your head is not your master. One of the most damaging illusions is believing every thought we think. The voice in your head is loud, but it is not always wise. The Stoics treated the inner monologue with skepticism. The soul becomes dyed with the color of its thoughts, Marcus Aurelius wrote. Then why would we let it soak in poison? Your mind will whisper things like, "You're not good enough. They don't respect you. You'll never make it." Stop. Who said that? Who gave that voice authority? What evidence does it have? You must become a critic of your inner critic, not with more judgment, but with curiosity. Don't approach it with hostility, but with examination. Ask it questions with the seriousness of a philosopher and the compassion of a friend. What is it trying to tell you? Where did it come from? Often, the inner critic is not even your voice. It is an echo of past experiences, a shadow of voices that were once external: parents, teachers, peers, bosses, cultural standards, that have since been absorbed into your own mind and taken root as if they belong there. These voices whisper not truth, but repetition. By questioning the origin and purpose of this voice, you begin to separate your authentic self from the inherited noise. You start to draw a boundary between what is real and what is residue. The goal is not to silence the voice, but to strip it of unearned power. It will still speak, but it won't command. You may still hear it when you feel weak, tired, or uncertain, but it no longer directs your actions or controls your identity. You are not at war with it. You are taking the reins. You are reclaiming authorship of your inner dialogue, transforming what was once a hostile voice into a background murmur. Treat it like a wild horse. It can run, it can kick, it can make noise, but you are the one who decides where it goes. With time, the wildness of those thoughts becomes energy you can repurpose. You learn to harness its force instead of being thrown off course. It becomes an instrument, not an intruder. Some thoughts are just noise. Some are echoes from a past version of you. Some are habits your mind has rehearsed for years, and some are simply fears dressed up as facts, illusions pretending to be evidence. create a gap between thought and identity. This is one of the most liberating shifts you can make as a human being. It is the boundary between bondage and freedom. When you no longer believe everything you think, you liberate yourself from the tyranny of mental noise. Thoughts are visitors, not permanent residents. They are impulses, not identities. They may arise spontaneously, but they don't have to become your reality. They do not define you. They simply pass through, like clouds across the sky. They arise from moods, fatigue, hunger, hormones, old wounds, random memories, and unresolved tension. But they are not you. They are not your voice of truth. They are often echoes of habit, emotion, or unchallenged narratives. You are not your thoughts. You are the thinker, the observer, the gatekeeper, the steward of your own inner kingdom. You are the one who chooses what stays and what goes. And with awareness, you can choose which thoughts deserve your energy, your belief, and your reaction. You can respond to a thought the same way you'd respond to a stranger yelling on the street, with skepticism, with distance, and with a firm sense of grounded selfhood. Some thoughts are worth listening to, others are simply noise dressed in urgency. You learn to observe without absorbing. You begin to hear your thoughts without believing them, to sit with them like a monk watches flames, without flinching, without jumping in, to be present without being overwhelmed, to notice your mind race and yet choose not to chase it, to recognize an inner storm and say, "I don't have to walk into it." You gain the freedom to let a thought pass without it having to define your mood or your worth. You realize that just because a thought is loud doesn't mean it's true. Just because it is familiar doesn't mean it is useful. That freedom, that awareness, is the foundation of mental strength. It is the quiet mastery that defines those who walk in peace amidst noise. It is the ability to be surrounded by confusion and yet hold your center. The strength to smile in uncertainty, to stay silent when provoked, to think clearly even while pressure builds. The skill to know that peace is not the absence of thought, but the mastery of it. When you build that space between you and your thoughts, you reclaim the power that negativity has stolen from you. That gap becomes a border between the noise of the mind and the peace of the self. You begin to carve out a space of clarity within the storm, a sanctuary untouched by drama, fear, or confusion. That space grows as you nurture it, and soon it becomes a place you can return to at any moment, the still point within your own awareness. You stop living in reaction and begin living in reflection. Life no longer pulls you like a puppet on emotional strings. Instead, you learn to respond, not from your wounds, not from your insecurities, but from your principles. You begin to live from intention, not from inner noise. The world becomes less about what happens to you and more about how you choose to show up in it. You stop fighting your thoughts and begin directing them. You understand that your value does not rise and fall with every passing emotion or anxious prediction. You move from victim to guardian, no longer helpless in the face of your own mind, but protective of your peace and purposeful in your thinking. You go from being a sponge that soaks up every thought to being a lighthouse that stands firm amid every wave, radiating presence instead of absorbing chaos. Each mental storm becomes an opportunity to shine steadier, not to sink deeper. And in doing so, you become the architect of your mind, not the tenant of your doubts. You begin to take ownership of the way you think, and in doing so, you reshape the way you live. You no longer reside inside a mind that drifts. You command it, steer it, mold it into an ally. This inner leadership spreads. You design your inner life with clarity, with values, with patience, with strength. And from that inner structure, all of your outer life begins to change. Your decisions become clearer. Your relationships become healthier. Your path becomes more aligned. Everything external becomes an extension of the order you've created within, and that order becomes your unshakable advantage in a chaotic world. For 1 week, talk back to your inner critic. Every time it offers a negative thought, think of a counter-response grounded in fact or stoic wisdom. Build the habit of internal dialogue that serves you, not sabotages you. Chapter 5. Train the mind like a warrior trains the body. Discipline is not punishment, it is preparation. It is the foundation of self-mastery and the path to internal strength. To kill negative thinking, you must build a mind like a fortress, solid, alert, and immune to the corrosive effects of doubt, self-pity, and panic. This type of mind does not emerge from wishful thinking. It does not appear because you read one good quote. It is built, brick by brick, through repeated effort, clarity of purpose, and unwavering consistency. This does not happen by chance. It happens through training, through repetition, through intentional daily action. The Stoics knew this truth and lived it. They did not hope to feel strong. They practiced being strong in silence long before adversity showed up. Marcus Aurelius wrote nightly reflections, not because he needed to perform, but because he needed to sharpen. Each page was a sharpening stone for his judgment. Epictetus lectured on the control of impressions because he knew the first battle was internal. The first impression often lies, and to resist that impression is a form of moral strength. Seneca practiced voluntary discomfort, walking barefoot in winter and eating with little, because he knew hardship rehearsed made true hardship less frightening. These were not rituals of show, they were habits of self-mastery. They were proof that the mind, like the body, grows stronger through resistance. They lived this principle not occasionally, but daily. You must do the same. Your mind is a battlefield, and in that battle, the enemy is not the world. It is your own untrained thinking. It is the noise that slips in when you're vulnerable. It's the habits you've left unchecked, the thoughts you've allowed to roam freely without question. Negativity is relentless. It shows up when you're tired, when you're alone, when you're afraid, when you're doubting. It doesn't knock. It slithers in through the cracks, through the silence, through the pauses where discipline should be. It waits for your weakest moment and wraps itself around your thoughts like smoke, making it hard to see clearly. If you do not train daily, you will be conquered, not dramatically, but gradually. Not in one grand collapse, but in a thousand tiny concessions. A slow erosion of confidence, a quiet decay of clarity, a dulling of your edge, so subtle you don't notice until it's gone. But if you train, through journaling, reframing, silence, physical discipline and mental rehearsal, you will become stronger than your thoughts. You will sharpen the blade of your awareness. You will become vigilant, not just of what you do, but of what you allow to grow in your mental garden. You will begin to replace default negativity with earned clarity. You will no longer accept emotional sabotage as normal. You will stop waiting for peace and start creating it. Not just in your environment, but in your own nervous system, your own breath, your own internal response. Peace is not something found. It is built, cultivated, rehearsed like a martial art of the soul. Each negative impulse is an invitation to practice. It is your mental gym, your psychological dojo. Every time negativity rises, it brings with it the opportunity to respond with clarity instead of collapse. Do not see these impulses as failures. They are training sessions. Do not fear the discomfort of confronting them. This is your rehearsal space for resilience. Don't run from it. Train with it. Get familiar with the tension, with the sting of the first impulse, and learn to breathe through it. Let it become your sparring partner, not your captor. The more you engage with it consciously, the less intimidating it becomes. You begin to see each emotional surge not as a threat, but as an invitation to demonstrate self-mastery. Each emotional storm is a test of your preparation. It asks not just what you believe, but whether you embody it. It is asking you, are you who you say you are when the wind rises? Can you stay composed when the room gets loud, when life goes off script, when control slips from your fingers? Every difficult conversation, every rejected idea, every moment of discouragement is your chance to apply what you've rehearsed, not to prove something to others, but to yourself. It's a chance to demonstrate that what you practice in quiet, you can uphold under pressure. Show up, not for perfection, but for progress, not to impress, but to improve. The Stoic does not aim to never be moved, but to be unmoved by what does not deserve control. The real Stoic does not need a smooth sea. They prepare to sail in storms. The goal isn't to never fall, it's to fall better, less often, and to rise faster each time, with more wisdom in your pocket than before. Kill the habit of negativity, one repetition at a time, one reframed thought that cuts off a spiral before it becomes a storm, one calm response that breaks the chain of generational reactivity and rewrites the legacy of chaos into clarity. One courageous act when silence would have been easier, but integrity required that you speak. One moment where you held your tongue when anger surged like fire through your veins, and in that silence preserved your dignity. One moment where you chose faith over fear, patience over panic, reason over retaliation, and walked away not weaker, but stronger. These repetitions are not small, they are sacred. They are quiet acts of rebellion against the inertia of emotional chaos. They are the invisible victories that sculpt a new identity. These moments accumulate. They become spiritual weightlifting for the soul. With each one, you stack inner strength, layer discipline, and chisel character. They form the blueprint of transformation, the kind of change that is earned, not gifted, the kind of growth that only emerges when resistance is faced, not avoided. They forge the mental toughness you need to stand tall in the face of chaos and remain unbroken within. When the world shouts, you remain rooted. When your emotions scream, you answer with stillness. They build an internal momentum, compounding strength like compound interest, each moment of control feeding the next, each exercise of restraint reinforcing the last. The gains may be quiet, but they are exponential. Over time, what once rattled you now refines you. What once broke you now becomes the weight that builds you. They sculpt a spirit that cannot be bent by circumstance, because it has already bent itself through training and risen stronger. That spirit becomes your shield. It becomes your compass. It becomes your sanctuary in a world that is always shifting. They turn your mind into a fortress, not to keep the world out, but to protect what is most worthy inside, your virtue, your clarity, your inner freedom. Because once your thoughts are disciplined, no storm can shake your foundation. Once your emotions are mastered, no insult can define your worth. And once your mind is forged by repetition, it is no longer a battlefield. It is a sanctuary of purpose. Create a Stoic morning ritual. Begin your day not by scrolling, but by centering. Read one Stoic quote, something from Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, or Seneca. Let it be a guiding star for the rest of your day. Don't rush through it. Reflect on the meaning. Ask yourself how it applies to your life right now. Then, meditate for 5 minutes. Sit in stillness. Breathe with intention. Let your thoughts come and go without judgment. Anchor yourself in the present moment. Feel your body grounded, your awareness expanding. After that, journal one thought you will reframe today. Write down something that normally triggers anxiety or negativity, then rewrite it through a Stoic lens. Ask yourself, how can I see this differently? What does this challenge offer me? What virtue can I strengthen here? patience, courage, temperance. Visualize your day ahead. Picture yourself handling difficult conversations with composure, delays with calm, and uncertainty with resilience. Think of this ritual as your daily armor. You are preparing your mind for the battles of emotion, reaction, and distraction. Then enter the day armed, not aimless. You will walk into your responsibilities not unprepared, but trained. Discipline will breed clarity, and clarity will become your power. Chapter 6. Starve the story, feed the truth. Negative thinking is not just a single thought, it's a story. A looped narrative we tell ourselves about who we are, what we're capable of, and what the world is like. These stories become scripts, shaping how we interpret life. Without realizing it, we begin to live by them. They guide our reactions, mold our identities, and set invisible limitations. They go unchallenged for years, sometimes decades, simply because they feel familiar. But familiarity is not the same as truth. Just because something feels natural doesn't mean it's correct. Just because we've thought it a thousand times doesn't make it accurate. The Stoics taught that truth must be sought like a craftsman seeks excellence, with daily precision, intentional repetition, and discernment. Marcus Aurelius would write repeatedly, "Is this essential? We must learn to ask, is this true?" That question is the chisel in the hand of the Stoic sculptor, carving away illusion to reveal clarity. And not just once, but again and again. If the answer is no, then we must let that thought go, no matter how long it's lived with us, no matter how deeply it has woven into our habits. This is not merely positive thinking, it is disciplined clarity. The story might be, "No one appreciates me," but the truth might be, "I'm expecting validation from people who are incapable of giving it." The story might be, "I'm always behind." The truth might be, "I've made progress and I'm judging myself against someone else's race." The story might be, "I'm not cut out for this." But the truth might be, "I've never allowed myself to grow through failure without shame." The stories we tell ourselves are sticky, emotionally charged, and deeply ingrained. But they are not immune to inspection. The moment we dissect them, we reclaim agency. Each truth we discover under a lie is a form of liberation. When you starve the story and feed the truth, you stop feeding the monster of negativity. You stop rewarding the brain's addiction to drama, self-pity, and exaggerated thinking. You stop reinforcing the mental loops that keep you locked in self-doubt, shame, and defeatism. You start weakening the mental shortcuts that have grown stronger through unchallenged repetition. You teach your mind to prefer honesty over indulgence, simplicity over speculation. You begin to replace the seductive pull of dramatized thinking with the steady foundation of facts. The inner monologue that once sounded like a courtroom now becomes a place of thoughtful inquiry. Instead of reacting to fear-based narratives, you pause and investigate. You become a mental detective, probing, questioning, breaking apart old assumptions that have never been proven true. You no longer jump to conclusions. You sit with uncertainty. You demand evidence before belief. You begin to live from a place of thoughtful authorship, where your words, reactions, and choices are deliberate, not automatic. You become an editor of your thoughts instead of a servant to them. You stop being an actor in someone else's script, whether that script was written by your past, by others' expectations, or by the echo of old pain, and begin writing your own. And from that authorship, clarity replaces chaos. The fog lifts, decisions become less agonizing, emotions become less overwhelming. You start designing your mental environment, brick by brick, line by line, thought by thought, and what you build becomes the stronghold of your peace. Identify one recurring negative story you tell yourself. Then write three objective facts that challenge it. Post these facts where you see them daily. Let the truth interrupt the loop. Chapter 7. Reclaiming your inner authority. Negative thinking often flourishes when we outsource our sense of worth to others. We allow strangers, critics, even imagined audiences to dictate how we feel about ourselves. The Stoics called this slavery of the soul. Don't give circumstances the power to rouse anger, Epictetus said. That power is reserved for reason alone. In other words, you are the only rightful authority over your mind, but you must claim it. Every time you let a comment ruin your day, you abdicate your throne. You hand the keys of your emotional life to someone who may not even understand the weight of their words. Every time you dwell on someone's opinion, you weaken your stance. You loosen the foundation of your confidence and anchor your identity to shifting shadows. You were not made to be ruled by whispers. You were not created to take orders from glances or be shaken by judgments that carry no true authority. You were made to walk in sovereignty, with your spine aligned with your values and your mind unshaken by passing opinions. To kill negative thinking, you must stop negotiating your self-worth. Your value is not a bargaining chip to be traded for approval, nor is it a mirror to be held up by others. You must return power to its rightful place, within. You must reclaim it like stolen territory, with firmness and clarity. The Stoics didn't seek validation. They sought virtue. They anchored themselves not in applause, but in principle. They looked inward for strength and upward for perspective. And virtue does not depend on applause. It is built in silence, tested in difficulty, and honored in how you carry yourself, even when no one is watching. You were not meant to be popular. You were meant to be powerful in principle. Set a boundary. For the next 7 days, do not ruminate on anyone's opinion unless you would trade lives with them. Use that filter ruthlessly. Your mind deserves better gatekeeping. Chapter 8. Turning resistance into fuel. Negative thinking often shows up as resistance, the voice that says, "Why bother?" or "You'll fail anyway." This resistance is not a signal to stop. It's a signal to go. The Stoics viewed resistance as the proving ground of discipline. "The impediment to action advances action," Marcus Aurelius wrote. "What stands in the way becomes the way." This is not poetic fluff. It is battlefield philosophy. The Stoics didn't retreat from resistance. They leaned into it. That voice of doubt, train against it. Don't retreat from it. Confront it like a worthy opponent who sharpens your skill. See it not as an enemy to be feared, but as a signal that you've reached the edge of your comfort zone, where transformation begins. Each time it appears, treat it as a call to arms, an alert that you've entered the very zone where growth lives. Resistance is not random, it is precise. It shows up exactly where your breakthrough wants to be. That internal pushback, use it to practice consistency, to deepen your discipline, and to double down on your direction. Reframe the struggle as evidence that you are moving forward, not failing. Resistance is not just a wall, it's a signal. It's the mind's way of testing your seriousness. It is the space between who you are and who you're becoming. Every moment of resistance is a moment to reaffirm your direction, to draw your line in the sand. It's a decision point, a fork in the road where most people stop, but the Stoic chooses to continue, knowing that comfort is the enemy of mastery. Resistance is not your enemy. It is your weight to lift, your mirror to face, your sharpening stone to press against. It is the environment where strength is born, where clarity is formed, and where the true character of a person is revealed. The more you respond to resistance with action, the weaker the negative voice becomes. You rob it of its authority. You take away its oxygen. You no longer argue with it. You overpower it through discipline. With each step forward, Your identity shifts. You no longer see yourself as someone who stops when it gets hard, but as someone who shows up despite it, because of it. You begin to anticipate resistance and prepare for it, not fear it. You realize it's not silence you seek. It's momentum. It's not about removing the friction. It's about moving through it with precision and purpose. It's the rhythm of consistent movement, of repeated steps in the direction of your principles, like a sculptor chiseling away at stone. With momentum, the voice of doubt fades into the background, outpaced by your own progress, until all that remains is movement, clarity, and the echo of your own discipline. Identify the one action you most resist today. Take 5 minutes to do it anyway. Build a daily resistance ritual, a habit of facing what your mind wants to avoid. That is the gym of the Stoic mind. Chapter 9. Practicing Emotional Austerity. In a world obsessed with expression, the Stoic practices restraint. Not because emotion is evil, but because untrained expression is often destructive. This is not repression, it is mastery. It is the art of choosing when and how to act on what you feel, not letting feelings drive you like a wild horse with no reins. Emotional austerity is the ability to hold space between feeling and action. It is the muscle of mature thought, forged in daily discipline, refined by reflection, and shaped by trials that test your patience and resolve. It is not the denial of emotion, it is the refinement of it. The Stoic does not feel less than others, they simply act with greater intention. Seneca said, "No man is more unhappy than he who never faces adversity, for he is not permitted to prove himself." The Stoic does not run from adversity, they welcome it as a forge. They understand that emotional discomfort is not the problem, it is the process. The Stoic uses emotional discomfort as a sharpening stone, not to deny pain, but to harness it, not to suppress it, but to repurpose it into clarity, focus, and deeper strength. They take their suffering and shape it into something useful. That is power, not loud, but enduring. Negative thinking often escalates because we allow every emotional spark to become a wildfire. We feel something and we follow it without pause. We let the emotion carry us down a path we never questioned. We pour fuel on it with rumination, reaction, and storytelling. We spin scenarios that haven't happened, predict disasters based on fear, and interpret every delay or misstep as a sign of failure. We create entire catastrophes in our minds before anything real has occurred. Emotional austerity teaches us to step back, observe, and choose. It reminds us that emotional urgency does not equal truth, that just because we feel something strongly does not mean we must act on it immediately. It reminds us that not every emotion deserves an audience. Not every inner wave needs to become an outer storm. Not every sensation is a signal. It gives us the strength to wait before speaking, to breathe before reacting, and to reflect before judging. It creates a space between stimulus and response, a space where character is forged, virtue is chosen, and chaos is diffused. You can feel disappointment without declaring defeat. That initial sting of falling short doesn't have to spiral into self-loathing. You can recognize the setback, breathe, and still hold your posture, head high, purpose intact. You can experience sadness without surrendering to hopelessness. Sadness can move through you without taking root in you. It can be a cloud, not a cage. You can feel anger without becoming cruel, without letting your fire consume the people around you. You can let it fuel clarity and righteous action, not reckless harm. You can feel fear without abandoning your mission. You can walk into uncertainty not because you're fearless, but because you're faithful to your values. You can sit with shame without letting it write your worth. Shame may whisper lies, but you are not required to listen. You can meet it with compassion, recognize its source, and still refuse to let it become your identity. You can acknowledge emotion without allowing it to rule. Emotions are powerful, but you are more powerful. This is the Stoic ideal. Not coldness, but composure. Not hardness, but harmony. Not suppression, but strategic pause. Not silence, but selective response. The Stoic doesn't suppress. They govern. They lead from within, like a captain steady at the helm through crashing waves. They feel the full storm, acknowledge the waves crashing within them, and still walk through it with direction and integrity. They do not deny their humanity, they elevate it. They stand firm not because they are emotionless, but because they are emotionally trained. They have studied themselves. They have sat in silence with their anger, stared down their fear, and befriended their sadness. Not to indulge it, but to understand it. They've chosen to respond, not react. And that inner authority, that quiet command over the self, is what separates strength from chaos and mastery from emotional slavery. That is what Stoicism offers, not detachment from feeling, but dominion over it, not numbness, but nuance, not emptiness, but empowered calm. Practice emotional fasting. Choose one emotion you often indulge, such as frustration, worry, resentment, or guilt, and for one day, observe it without feeding it. Don't try to suppress it, but don't let it dictate your behavior either. Notice how it rises, how it tugs at your thoughts, how it tries to steer your attention. Instead of reacting, simply witness it as if it belongs to someone else. Ask yourself where it comes from, what it tries to protect you from, and what it might be masking underneath. Treat this emotion like a guest you are learning to understand, rather than a master you are forced to obey. Write down your observations throughout the day. Track how many times it appears and in what situations. Journal what it feels like to hold space for it, not engage with it, like a storm passing across the sky while you remain rooted on the ground. Notice the pull to react, and then practice pausing. This is not weakness. It is advanced training in inner control. By the end of the day, reflect on how much power that emotion holds when left unchallenged, and how much calmer your mind feels when you let the emotion exist without giving it momentum. This is emotional fasting, not deprivation, but refinement. It teaches you not to fear your emotions, but to stand beside them with steadiness and self-possession. Chapter 10. The Discipline of Inner Stillness. The final battle against negative thinking is won in stillness. Not just silence around you, but silence within you. The kind of stillness that quiets the commentary, slows the racing thoughts, and opens space for inner clarity. This is the summit of the Stoic path, freedom from disturbance, clarity of being. It is the moment when your mind no longer reacts like a storm to every gust of emotion, but responds like a lake, reflective, deep, unmoved by surface winds. Stillness is not emptiness. It is presence. It is awareness without attachment. It is the power to hear your own mind without echoing the world's chaos. Marcus Aurelius, amidst wars and political crisis, would return to stillness daily. Nowhere you can go is more peaceful, more free than your own soul. In those quiet moments, he trained his clarity, sharpened his values, and anchored himself against the tides of anxiety. He didn't wait for peace to find him. He created it, returned to it, and lived from it. Stillness is not passive. It is the most active form of resistance against inner chaos. This is the antidote to negativity, not distraction, not escape, but deep, grounded presence. A presence that watches the mind try to spiral and simply holds firm. A presence that is not threatened by discomfort, but deepened by it. When you learn to sit with yourself, undisturbed by judgment or frenzy, the storm of negative thinking dies from lack of reaction. Your mind learns that not every thought needs engagement, not every wave needs a boat. Stillness sharpens your awareness. It makes the invisible patterns of thinking visible. It reveals the illusions of thought, the catastrophizing, the assumptions, the emotional echoes of the past pretending to be truth. It reminds you, you are not your fear, you are not your mood, you are not the voice of doubt in your head. You are the space in which these things pass. You are the one who watches, who chooses, who builds strength not through noise, but through quiet authority. Commit to a daily stillness practice. Sit for 10 minutes each day in quiet observation of your thoughts. Do not judge, do not engage, just watch. Over time, the voice of negativity will grow quieter, not because it is gone, but because you have stopped listening. Killing your negative thinking is not a one-time act. It is a discipline, a practice, a vow you make every morning and every night. The Stoics knew the power of repetition. They knew that the mind, like the body, must be trained relentlessly. You are not weak because you have negative thoughts. You are only weak if you let them rule. But you can choose otherwise. Every breath is a chance to return to reason. Every trigger is a chance to train. Every moment is an invitation to master the self. Kill your negative thinking, not by violence, but by vigilance. Not by suppression, but by awareness. Not by fantasy, but by grounded discipline. Let your mind be a temple of clarity, not a prison of chaos. Live the Stoic way, not someday, but today. And remember, you don't need to control the world. Just control your thoughts. That is where your freedom begins.